Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Safe. We're taping this a little bit later in the day, but that gives us the chance to update ourselves on a news cycle that even by modern standards is moving awfully quickly. And we have to talk about the president's tweet. So joining us is Matt Lewis, who is a senior columnist for The Daily Beast. Welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, Charlie. Good to be back.
Well, okay, let's just start off with this, okay? I'm looking at the President of the United States tweeted, As I have stated strongly before, and just to reiterate, if Turkey does anything that I, in my great and unmatched wisdom, consider to be off limits, I will totally destroy and obliterate the economy of Turkey, word economy capitalized. I've done before, exclamation point, they must with Europe and others watch over the captured ISIS fighters and families, blah, 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 blah. Okay, what do you make of that?
Well, I think that he wants to walk away a little bit from what's probably going to happen. I mean, you know, so first of all, why did Trump make this weird announcement that he was going to basically throw the Kurds to the wolves? Was he doing it to distract attention? Who knows, right? He's so chaotic. But then why does he come out with this tweet basically promising to do something he can't promise to do? I mean, as long as American troops are there, then the Kurds are basically safe. Once we withdraw and essentially hand it over to the Turks, who, by the way, view the Kurds as terrorists, all bets are off. I don't know why Trump is doing this to begin with. I don't really know why he's tweeting this. Secondly.
Okay, well, okay, I was going for the Wizard of Oz vibe there. The I in my great and unmatched wisdom. I mean, this is the insanity of the Orange God King. I mean, yes, you can say, well, he's walking it back, but there's even by the crazy standards of our day, this was a disturbing tweet. And the worst part about it is this tweet was supposed to reassure everybody that don't worry, right. I got this. And everybody else is looking around going, you have just betrayed some of our most loyal and dependable allies. They lost 11,000 men fighting against ISIS. The betrayal runs so deep because we induce them to dismantle many of their defenses, promising them, don't worry about this. We got your back. Betray them in the middle of the night. They are looking at the possibility of ethnic cleansing and genocide. The blowback on this is extraordinary in that it seems to be across the political lines. Republicans who have never come out of the tall grass to criticize the president are coming out now. And you get this grandiloquent, this megalomaniac style tweet, I in my great and unmatched wisdom. Now, there's two ways. You could go the Marco Rubio route and going, well, he's trolling you guys, right? He's kidding. Except the whole point of this is to send a deadly serious warning to the world and to Turkey. So what do you make? I mean, this is like, where do the defenders go on this one?
Right. Well, and let me say it is very serious. Erdogan has said that he would, quote, drown the Kurds in Syria. And Turkey's defense minister said they will be, quote, buried in their ditches. So this is for real. Everything that you thought the Republican Party stood for, the party of Reagan, things like moral clarity have gone out the window in China and in Syria. And we're basically trading long-term things, including the trust of America that our allies would have in us, for short-term political benefits of Donald Trump, and in some cases, personal benefits. The tweet, look, I think that there are a couple things at play here. I think that there is a sense that they want to perpetuate the idea that there's something magical, mystical about Trump. I also think this thing about him joking and trolling, I've seen this in the alt-right. We haven't heard much about the alt-right for a little
lulls,
while.
Yeah.
But what they do is it's almost a nihilistic thing where they'll say something outrageous that will erode norms. And if you are offended by it or take it seriously, then you're like a normie who doesn't get the joke. If you don't become offended, then you're basically being desensitized to it. And so in a way, what Trump does here, it's a nothing is real, nothing matters. way of basically he can throw something out. And if you want to believe that it's a joke, then it's a joke. If you want to believe it's serious, it's serious. It's the erosion of meaning and purpose. It's a postmodern thing that Donald Trump is espousing, and it's really the opposite of what conservatives ought to believe in.
Okay, so let's talk about Lindsey Graham. This is extraordinary. So Lindsey Graham, who has been the president's loyalist defender, right? I mean, this has been the whole bargain that Lindsey Graham has made with Donald Trump. You know, I'll be your guy. You know, I'll be your, you know, your sidekick. I will suck up to you. I will kiss up to you. And the rationalization you would assume is, well, at least I stay close. I can be relevant. He'll have to listen to me. I will be in the room, and I will prevent exactly the kind of decision that was just made. And now Lindsey Graham is out there saying, by abandoning the Kurds, we have sent the most dangerous signal possible that America is an unreliable ally, and it's just a matter of time before China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea act out in dangerous ways. I mean, it just, and he goes on and on and on. So where does this leave Lindsey Graham? I mean, Lindsey Graham's entire Faustian bargain with Trump was based on this sort of thing, and apparently he was not in the loop. He got no heads up on it, was not consulted, and you have Trump going, you know, full Rand Paul.
As you were saying that, I was thinking they ought to do a parody, you know, that if you'll be my bodyguard, I will be your long lost friend.
Yeah.
Someone should sing that with the Lindsey Graham accent. That's like an Imus circa 1990-something move. Look, Rick Wilson wrote the book, Everything Trump Touches Dies. And I think that there's so many things that are going to come out of the Donald Trump era. Earlier, I talked about how all the things, the Republican brand, moral clarity, belief in law enforcement, strength, you know, peace through strength, standing up for our allies. I mean, all those things, those are all out the window. One of the other externalities that will come from Donald Trump is the destruction of a generation of Republicans. Everybody on the scene right now has been, who's a Republican, has to some degree or another lost credibility by virtue of any time they've ever done anything to vouch for Donald Trump or even worked with him. Nikki Haley is one of the people who probably has come out looking the best. And even she, from time to time, has been tarnished by this. And so to me, it's just another example. It doesn't matter what you do. It is the deal with the devil. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work out.
But is this different? Does this mark anything different? And our colleague Jim Swift put together a list of Republicans and their reaction. And right there, Nikki Haley, who put out a tweet, "We must always have the backs of our allies if we expect them to have our back. The Kurds were instrumental in our successful fight against ISIS in Syria. Leaving them to die is a big mistake." Even Marco Rubio issued a statement. Of course, Romney's out there. So earlier today, I wrote an article, Romney Alone, that Romney was pretty much the only guy who was willing to take a stand against Trump. And now we're sitting here, and one Republican after another, including Mitch McConnell and Pat Toomey and Marsha Blackburn, Liz Cheney, Lindsey Graham, we just mentioned, are issuing statements saying this is a terrible, terrible mistake. The president has betrayed our ally, made us look weak, has actually strengthened the hand of the terrorists. You get this bizarre tweet from Trump. Is this different in the sense that now Republicans are actually breaking from him openly and rather vigorously on an issue of real substance?
I don't know. I think on one hand, we have seen examples where people, I mean, for one thing, this has happened before, right? I mean, General Mattis resigned over this, and the same people said some of the same things. And then Trump basically moved on to the next controversy. So it's not like people haven't, from time to time, criticized him on certain things. Will this add up to something else? We don't know yet. I will say that if people can criticize Trump with impunity, that opens the door for more. If there's a sense that you can get away with it. And so maybe that's part of what this is. I actually think that there's a chance, and I want to use the, you know, I want to italicize the word chance here. I think it's possible you get enough senators. You need 20 to remove him from office. I've begun to believe, not that it's likely, but that it is within the realm of possibility. And of course, the reason is that this is a dynamic process. One person does it, then another person does it. And if Trump keeps doing crazy things, and that is how you basically could end up there. I don't think it's possible.
I have it here in my notes, you know, that you wrote there's a chance that there'd be 20 Republican senators. And I have written down, I just want you to know, I have written down right behind it, I want a little bit of what Matt is having. I want to smoke what Matt is smoking. But as we sit here today, you do get the sense that there are people in Washington, in the United States Senate, who are now who if they ever had any private confidence in the judgment of the president, are rattled by this.
Yeah.
And you also make an interesting point about the pack mentality. When it's one person out there, you know, there was a piece over the weekend in the Washington Post comparing Republicans to sort of a herd of frightened zebras that nobody wants to leave the pack, otherwise you're eaten by the lion. So the only one who's left the pack so far, again, is Mitt Romney. But if you have a bunch, if you start off with 6 or 7 or 8, can Trump attack them all by Twitter? Can he go after all of them? And then what happens when he begins insulting members of his jury? How do their colleagues begin to react to that? Right. So you when I ask, is this changing anything? This seems like a day in which people are going, you know, my God, the recklessness of this president is having real-world consequences in a way that I just can't go along with it, and frankly seems very off-brand for him. I mean, it's the kind of thing that actually could rattle some folks in the base, which we've said before and hasn't happened, but this one feels pretty bad.
Right, and things keep coming out. There was the Volcker stuff, the diplomat stuff. There's the China stuff. I mean, every day it's something else. And listen, you know, Mitt Romney is the first, and no one has really defended him that I know of. But let's go through it sounds crazy to think you get to 20 until you start actually looking at names, right? You've got Susan Collins.
No, it still sounds crazy. I just want to be on record here.
All right, Susan Collins of Maine, who said it's a big mistake to ask China to investigate him.
Right.
She potentially benefits from this, right? Mm. She's from Maine. Then you've got people like Cory Gardner, Martha McSally, Tom Tillis, people who basically are up for reelection. They probably blow with the wind if it benefits them to stick with Trump electorally, and it may, they stick with him. Then you've got a lot of people, or several people, who are retiring. You know, people like Jerry Moran of Kansas or Mike Inslee of Wyoming. Lamar Alexander. You've got people that are immune politically. Lisa Murkowski ran as a write-in. So she can do what she wants. You've got Mike Lee, who's a constitutional conservative from Utah. He's probably immune. Then you've got people like Ben Sasse and Marco Rubio who could rediscover their courage. And so, again, I'm not saying it's likely, but at some point you're at double digits and it starts to get real.
Okay, since we're going down this rabbit hole, what would have to happen? What would the precipitating piece of evidence be? What would the precipitating event have to be? Because based on what we know now, they're going to fall into the usual categories, right? They'll get over this. I mean, if nothing else came out, right? They'll get over this. They'll go back to, you know, hating Nancy Pelosi, you know, hating Adam Schiff. We saw how far my good buddy Ron Johnson was willing to go on television over the weekend. So does it have to be something new, something really shaking, some, you know, a transcript of a phone call with Vladimir Putin where basically, you know, he promises to, you know, throw some fundamental American interest under the bus? I mean, what is it, anything?
Well, look, it's hard to imagine anything worse than what has already happened, actually. I don't think it's so much about, you know, the smoking gun or another shoe dropping per se, as it is about the internal politics of it. I mean, if they think, Jeff Flake said that he believes that there are 35 Republicans who would vote to remove if it was a secret ballot. If this is more about whether politically they can survive by doing this. Luckily, the U.S. Senate, the founders in their infinite wisdom, staggered these terms, right? So only a third of the senators are up for re-election this time. That gives some of them a little bit of leverage, or a little bit of a safety valve to do things that might not be politically popular today. So I don't think it's waiting for an external event as much as it's, first of all, it has to go to the Senate.
They're going to have to vote. Yeah,
they're going to have to vote one way or the other.
Yeah, no, I'm just way more cynical. But this comes. I got a question for you, because you've seen a number of previous Never Trumpers who've decided that, okay, you know what, it's a binary choice. You know, so Ben Shapiro, Eric Erickson, the folks who ran that Twitter handled the Reagan Battalion, people who had been solidly anti-Trump, are all going, now we're going to back the president. They by the way chose a rather odd time to get on board this particular train. It strikes me that you're undergoing something in the opposite direction. You seem to be, what's going on with you? You seem genuinely horrified by what's happening right now, and you seem to have upped your Never Trump game. Is that a fair characterization?
And as you know, Charlie, I've been a Trump critic the whole time, and wrote my book, Too Dumb to Fail, even before a single vote was cast.
Which inspired me throughout the entire campaign, and I've given you credit.
So I don't like to use the word hero to describe myself, but I've been pretty solid. But
you have been, yes.
But I will admit, I will confess that while other Never Trumpers have acquiesced and turned the other way, I've decided to turn up the heat a little bit. And it's because I think that I think this is even more, it's always been serious, but I think this is the time for choosing. And I don't know if you saw Jake Tapper's, I think it was a monologue.
I did.
That's during the State of the Union show, where he talked about the fact that this is basically a time for choosing. He talked about the McCarthy era. He talked about what your legacy is going to be and what's going to be in your obituary. That's how I see it. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm that important. But we're all going to have to stand in judgment. Our kids and our grandkids are all going to want to know something about what we did at this moment. I think it's an important time.
The reason I ask that is I follow you on Twitter, and I have the same experience often, you know, particularly when these stories come out about the Ukraine and about, you know, asking China to investigate the Bidens, and you watch the gaslighting and you say, how on earth can anyone defend this? But also, how on earth can you not see what we're seeing here? You know, it is so bad. And yet we have seen so many of our colleagues, people we have worked with, whose books we have read, people we have admired for years and years and years, who are willing to either defend it or apparently do not see what we're seeing.
Well, I mean, and just being honest, Charlie, and being like introspective, I mean, part of what I used to do is I would always condemn Trump when he did something I thought was wrong. But then I'd be sort of anxious. Let me write a piece criticizing the squad, because I think that they're bad too, right? I think that they're wrong too. And that was kind of what I did. And I felt that was intellectually honest, and I felt that it was appropriate. And I'm not going to say I'm never going to write another piece criticizing them, but what I've come to terms with right now is that Donald Trump, what he's doing to America, what he's doing to the conservative movement, it's such a top priority that to talk about something else, it has to be really important to justify that, because what Trump is doing deserves not just our criticism, but actually our focus and our attention on it.
Yeah, and I think that really comes into to focus today. But your last column was about Elizabeth Warren, wasn't it? I mean, it was, which basically is the same thing. I've written the same sort of thing. Like, you Democrats, are you really going to blow this? Are you really going to do something like this? So give me your take. Actually, you know what? I want to hear your take on Elizabeth Warren, because your column was, Democrats really aren't going to nominate another liberal from Massachusetts, are they?
Well, part of my premise is that this whole thing started, the Ukraine scandal started because Donald Trump used the power and the prestige of America and of the presidency to try to destroy Joe Biden,
his political rival. And may have succeeded. So let me hold that thought because I want to drop in a word from our sponsor, and then I want to come back and walk through this what I described over the weekend as kind of the murder suicide, but what a Warren nomination would be. But you know, first a word from our new sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by Simply Safe. A recent Gallup survey shows that Americans worry more about burglary than almost any other crime, more than mugging, more than terrorism, more than car theft and murder. And what's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes have home security. Maybe because most companies really don't make it that easy. And that's why Simply Safe is my top choice. Simply Safe protects your whole home, every window, room, and door, with 24/7 monitoring for just a fraction of the cost. Their police dispatch is up to 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. It's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. And it's really easy to order and easy to set up, usually in less than an hour. Simply Safe has won a ton of awards from CNET to the New York Times Wire Cutter, and prices are always fair and honest. Around-the-clock monitoring is just $15 a month. So visit simplysafe.com/bulwark. You'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure to go to simplysafe.com/bulwark so they know that our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/bulwark. We are back with Matt Lewis, a senior columnist for The Daily Beast, whose latest column really asked the question, are the Democrats really going to nominate another liberal from Massachusetts? So talk to me about that and whether or not, I mean, she is now, I think, reasonably the front runner. Would you agree?
I don't know. It's very close. But the fact that you say that is indicative of the trouble Joe Biden is in. I mean, Joe Biden should be the clear front runner, and he is not the clear front runner. That's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the poll numbers, you know, they are mixed. In Wisconsin, we had some numbers over the weekend from Fox News that suggested that he is, you know, by far and away the strongest Democrat. He beats Trump by double digits. Elizabeth Warren only leads him by about 4. But so your critique is it about her? Is it about her electability? Is that your main concern?
Yeah, I don't think, to me, it's astonishing that at the very moment where Donald Trump is using the power of America to try to destroy Joe Biden, Democrats are saying, oh, yeah, let's do what Trump wants. Let's get behind Elizabeth Warren. I thought that there might be some sort of rally around the flag effect, at least in the short term, that would benefit Biden, even if in the long term this would hurt him.
And
I don't know
still
if it's
happen.
A coincidence.
Yeah,
because Warren was surging. But it seems to me, look, Trump wants to get rid of Biden because he knows Biden is his toughest general election opponent. Why wouldn't Democrats see what Donald Trump sees?
Yeah, I think in part it's been Biden's, you know, lack of forceful pushback. His folks might disagree with us, but I think there was a piece over the weekend, and who knows why. So, what do you think about Elizabeth Warren? See, I think Elizabeth Warren is an immensely flawed candidate, and I think that that's going to become apparent relatively soon. In my newsletter this morning, I pointed out two big problems she has. Number one, she's been caught in another, shall we say, inconsistency, talking about her autobiography. She claimed that when she was a teacher, she was fired for being visibly pregnant. She told a very different story at a different point that cast doubt on that particular narrative. And number two, you got the big one, which is, you know, at some point she's going to have to explain how she pays for her Medicare for All and her reluctance to admit that it's going to be a massive tax increase on the middle class. And, you know, anybody that's been around politics any time in the last 30 years know that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, no, I think there are a ton of problems with Elizabeth Warren. Substantively, as you've laid out, I think that, the Pocahontas thing will come back to haunt her. I think that Trump will, it'll be a lot easier for Trump to mock her. There is this thing about her. You've put it better than anybody, Charlie, with the vibe of her being like an assistant middle school principal or something. And look, I mean, if you buy the argument that the Electoral College is what matters and that Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan are what matter, it's really hard to envision Warren being the better candidate than Biden. I mean, look, I think she has a chance to win once it's a binary choice. You know, who knows? But Joe Biden, I'm guessing that, you know, Joe Sixpack in Pennsylvania or Michigan may be more likely to pull the lever for Joe Biden. And the other option, of course, is to sort of run up the score with the Obama coalition to turn out more minorities. But is Elizabeth Warren really the best position to do that either? So whether you're talking about working class white dudes or minority voters, I think Joe Biden's better on both counts when it comes to winning against Trump.
Yeah, I think that the progressives have bought into two false narratives. Number one, the belief that there are no swing voters. I think that's demonstrably false. I think the fact that you have people who voted for Obama twice and then voted for Trump, that you had voters who have voted reliably Republican, who voted for Democrats in the midterm elections, you know, demonstrates there are voters who are in play, and those voters will determine the election. The other one is this whole idea of what it will take to mobilize the base. Look, if the presence of Donald Trump on the ballot does not mobilize progressives, what would? Do people really think that a specific policy prescription that is probably not going to be enacted is the magic bullet, that there are voters who will only turn out to vote against Donald Trump if they think they're going to get fully socialized medicine that bans private insurance companies? Does that voter really exist? And if they really exist, are they going to make the difference in Michigan and Ohio and Wisconsin and Iowa? I don't think so.
Yeah, no, it doesn't make any sense. And you should, one rule in politics and life and in battle is you don't do the thing your opponent wants you to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump wants Elizabeth Warren. And look, sometimes we get burned. We get what we want. You know, the Democrats thought Donald Trump would be easy to beat. I think they wanted Ronald Reagan. They thought he would be easy to beat. So sometimes it backfires. But by and large, I think it's a good rule of thumb to avoid doing the exact thing your opponent hopes you do. And that's what Democrats appear poised to be up to.
Okay, let's cycle back on where we started this remarkable moment where the president, apparently without consulting much of anyone, decides that he's going to abandon the Kurds. And of course, this is something really, frankly, that he's wanted to do for some time. And the adults in the room had pushed back against him. This is one of the reasons why General Mattis resigned as a matter of principle as Secretary of Defense. And for some reason, then the president kind of backed off. But this is something that Trump Unchained has always wanted to do. And, Lindsey Graham, for all of the sycophancy, was not able to stop it. The blowback, though, is so dramatic. And I'm looking here at Mitch McConnell's statement. A precipitous withdrawal of U.S. forces from Syria would only benefit Russia, Iran, and the Assad regime, and it would increase the risk that ISIS and other terrorist groups regroup. I urge the president to exercise American leadership to keep together our multinational coalition to defeat ISIS. Now, number one, that's a very, very strong statement coming from somebody that Trump really is going to need. Number two, it seems written specifically to target Trump's weak spots, which is you do not want to look like you are, in fact, strengthening the enemies of this country. So I guess the question is, by the time we're done with this podcast, is it possible that the president is going to back off? I mean, at this point, can Trump reverse his position without suffering substantial damage? Because I think given the blowback that has got to take him by surprise, there's a very real chance that he's going to cave in on this. And then, what signal does that send?
Well, that's the thing, right? So our tweets, presidential pronouncements.
Yes.
And this would be the second time that he had, this would constitute the second time that he said he was going to withdraw. And if he doesn't do it now, of course, I don't think he would have a big announcement saying I changed my mind. I think he would just move on to some new controversy. But that's like a red line. I mean, one of the things, one of the reasons that a lot of us were critical of Barack Obama is that when you say you're going to do something and then you don't do it, it's deflation in terms of the power of presidential rhetoric. Now, Trump has already basically done that, but it would just be one more example of where you can't trust America. You can't trust what they say. Really, at this point, that's true either way. Whether Trump screws over the Kurds or not, you really can't trust what America promises, what the president says.
Yeah. I mean, even if he backs off, I think his indecision, his recklessness, his unreliability, you know, is going to be on display. There's really no good scenario for him. I think it's obviously a good scenario for the world if, in fact, he backs off. So speaking of moral leadership around the world and the reliability, I just want to briefly touch on the NBA and the Chinese. I don't know if you've talked about this. The NBA being as craven as possible in essentially apologizing for comments made by the general manager of the Houston Rockets, and of course they're being absolutely filleted and justifiably so. People going, "What is with you that you are kowtowing to the Chinese?" But it's interesting the number of conservative commentators who are willing to go after the NBA for kowtowing to the Chinese, who have said nothing or are completely okay with the fact that the president of the United States has also basically promised to keep his mouth shut and kowtow to the Chinese over Hong Kong.
Yeah. I think this is part of the problem of how Donald Trump corrupts, is that if you're a conservative who has made a deal with Trump to look the other way on human rights abuses, on whatever, it really infects every part of your of your life, and it just, any time that you take a stand on anything else, now you're like a hypocrite. I mean, there's nothing that a Democratic president could do that the next Democratic president could do that most conservatives now wouldn't be hypocrites for criticizing him of. I mean, Marco Rubio came out, criticizing China, and it's hard to take these guys seriously when they turned a blind eye to other really egregious abuses, and now they want to cast themselves as like heroes, human rights champions, and whatnot.
Oh, I see. This was your tweet. I was going to think, I was now, where did I see this? It was you, Matt, who actually postulated a theory which I endorse completely about Marco Rubio. This is after Marco Rubio's appearance. They asked him about the president inviting China, of all people, to investigate the Bidens. And frankly, Rubio looked pathetic. I mean, Rubio's basically, oh, he was just joking. He's just trolling with the media, which was just ludicrous that he was saying that. And then your theory was, let me just paraphrase it, that the guys who were beaten during the 2016 primaries by Trump seemed to be the most psychologically weakened at the moment. That was you, right?
Yeah, that was me. And I think there's something to it.
I think there's something to that too.
And I'd love to have this discussion or sort of play around with this, because on one hand, it's really hard to tell who the biggest suck up is. I mean, there are a lot of people who have bended a knee to Donald Trump.
Lindsey Graham's the biggest suck up.
It's hard to rank order them, but if you look at Rubio's body language, it was really weird in that press briefing. And it does seem to me that the people who stood up to him and then were rolled over, it's almost like they've said, "I'll never make that mistake again."
Yeah, there's a brokenness about them.
Yes.
There is, and that really never occurred to me until I saw your tweet about that. And I thought, that is true, because I can remember I mean, I could remember when Marco Rubio was the great hope of the, you know, Republican Party, right? When I thought of him as a relatively strong leader, there were times when Ted Cruz looked like a strong leader who was willing to stand on principle. And you think about Paul Ryan, and but each of these guys beaten down by Trump really do have that distinctive, you know, hangdog demeanor. And just sort of, I can't bring myself to take this guy on, you know, vibe.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's especially true of people who had to, who were in the Congress and had to work with him afterward. Now, if Rubio had gone off into the sunset like he was going to do, maybe he would be different today. Because I don't think this problem, I don't think like Kasich or Jeb or Nikki Haley. There are others who, look, I'm not saying they come out of this looking great, but they're not as beaten down. It's almost like the abused wives syndrome, you know? They have to walk around on pins and needles.
Well, yeah, or with a Stockholm syndrome.
There's some psychological thing happening there. And if you look – now, I heard – this is not – I did not intend to be tough on Rubio like in the wake. I heard that his – after the fact, I heard that his mom has died recently.
Okay, and, well, yeah.
And that may be – so I would totally understand if that contributed to his kind of demoralization and feeling beat down, I mean, emotionally. But if you watch that, that was like a hostage video. I mean, his body language, it looks like a man thoroughly defeated. And again, it's a stark contrast from the guy that I thought very well may be the next Ronald Reagan. I mean, when Rubio announced for president, I have a picture of my son in front of the TV. Because I'm like, this could be like – we're not there. We're not important enough to be in the audience. But this could be like someday that picture of like Bill Clinton meeting John F. Kennedy. You know? This is a moment. And
I have a drawer. I have a drawer with pictures of where I'm standing with Marco Rubio. Put that in the drawer. With Ted Cruz. Put that in the drawer. Scott Walker. Put that in the drawer. The drawer is getting crowded. Hey, here's another reason why I think Trump might cave in on Syria. Because the pressure, it's one thing that he has Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell pushing back at him. That's serious enough. And across, even Nikki Haley was willing to speak out about this. But don't underestimate the significance of the fact that Pat Robertson, you know, everybody's crazy evangelical uncle, is going. Do you see what he said here? That he's appalled by the decision. And here's the quote: "The president of the United States is in great danger of losing the mandate of heaven if he permits this to happen." Okay, well, first of all, let's leave aside the crazy of the fact that Donald Trump ever had the mandate of heaven. But the one thing that this guy, I think, what Trump understands is don't screw with the evangelical base.
Yeah.
And
well,
and,
look, and, I'd say a couple of things here. Yeah. So first of all, I saw some website called Right Wing Watch or something like that.
I saw that.
Put this out. And I think they were intending, I assume they were intending to make fun of Pat Robertson. If you watch that whole clip, Robertson nailed. I mean, he was exercising moral authority and clarity on that. And a lot of what he said, he called Erdogan a thug, which I think is true. He was very clear. And look, the idea, people can scoff at the notion that that God looks at countries, and like I think Pat Robertson's gotten in trouble for like saying that God caused this hurricane to happen because he's judging us for whatever. But the idea that the Almighty does bless nations and could withhold a blessing because they are involved in things that are unseemly. I'm pretty sure people like FDR and Winston Churchill have said things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's not maybe as crazy as it sounds. I'd recommend watching that Pat Robertson thing. As, you know, you're right, Charlie. I mean, if Trump, if nothing else, this is good insurance for Mike Pence, right?
Oh absolutely. I keep looking around for who are going to be the people who are going to provide the greatest defense. I think, again, the cautionary images of Jim Jordan and Ron Johnson out there, that you go on, you have to defend the president, you go down these bizarre rabbit holes of conspiracy theories, lashing out, you know, attacking the media. It's just not a good look. And then, of course, I'm looking around to see who other than, you know, the usual suspects like Molly Hemingway and the Federalist, who are going to be defending Trump. You know, as you know,
what happened to them, Charlie?
You tell me.
I'm super curious about this. I really curious. Am.
I'm curious about the psychological effect of a lot of people who just decided that, you know, who have no illusions about who Trump is. They went down the, you know, the brand of, you know, anti Trump, as you well know.
But here's the thing: some of the most eloquent stuff written about the dangers of Trump were written by,
I know,
Ben Domenech, who wrote a piece that one of the first pieces I saw that said, like, supporting Trump is supporting white identity politics. A lot of these people were part of that National Review Against Trump magazine piece. And the fact that they turned around on that is bizarre.
Well, Lindsey Graham, I mean, when you go back to what Lindsey Graham said about Trump, could you be any stronger? I mean, you and I were very, very strong. But Lindsey Graham, you know, he says, this is what you're buying. He's a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot. He doesn't represent my party. He doesn't represent the values the men and women who wear the uniform are fighting for. If we nominate Trump, we will get destroyed and we will deserve it. And now, you know, and then up until today, he was the president's biggest defender.
Rubio called him a con artist. Yeah. I just read in Jeremy Peters' New York Times piece. Mm-hmm. I'd forgotten some of this. I'd forgotten. But like Eric Erickson said he would never, like, something like never, ever, ever, ever vote for him ever. Now he's voting for him, apparently.
Although tweeting criticism of it. Yeah, his timing could have been better for getting on board the train.
Well, whenever you like, there have been days throughout the last 3 years where I felt, wow, maybe Trump's not that bad. And anytime you start to think that, within an hour, he will do something to make you like, thank God I didn't like never said I would support him.
Well, you know, I mean, there's obviously the people who are, you know, in the fever swamps and the people who are, you know, the Mitchells. What's Mitchell's first name again? I'm forgetting now. Bill Mitchell, you know, I mean, the crazies.
Oh, yeah.
But then there are the ones who are the more thoughtful conservatives who have sort of drifted over into rationalization. And you and I have talked about this before. I've been very critical of, you know, Henry Olson, who's kind of a friend, you know, of both of us. I think you know Henry, right? And, you know, writing for The Washington Post. You see what his tweet is today? He said, as Trump's tweets go increasingly bizarre, one must ask whether we can gain guidance from Shakespeare's tragedy King Lear. We can, and the lessons are not comforting. And he writes, we should expect more of this behavior as the impeachment inquiry moves closer to fruition. An angry, bitter man who believes himself the victim of injustice will not go quietly into the night. So it's like even people who have been willing to provide layers of rationalization are saying, you know, you think it's crazy now. It's going to get a lot worse.
Right. But I think it might have been Ala Pundit who tweeted, like, the next line of defense from Trump's defenders is going to be, impeachment's going to make it, you know, don't impeach. It's going to make him do crazy things.
You're at fault.
It's like blaming the victim, right? You know, you're the one who made him beat you, you know?
Well, that's the one thing is the given in, it almost feels naive to think of that anything is going to change anything or be the breaking point, because over the last 3 years, his approval ratings have basically been impervious to the news cycle. They bounce within a few points. And you know that even the Republicans who are out there really strongly criticizing this move on Syria, within several news cycles, will be back to finding a way to attack the liberals, going back to attacking the squad and going, you know, the usual. And it certainly is possible that impeachment will be the one thing that Trump needs to rally folks. But, you know, you also, you know, you know that if there are 30, 35 senators who would vote in a secret ballot to remove Trump, that among that group, they have to be watching the president. They have to be looking at that Wizard of Oz tweet and going, oh my God, what are we in for? You know, are we going to be able to get through this? And are we really willing to back this guy for another 4 years? I mean, think about that. It's whether he should be president right now, whether or not he should be, you know, renominated, and whether or not he should get another 4 years in office. Can you imagine another 4 years in office if he's like this right now?
What are we going to look
like? A year before an election?
Have you seen those pictures of Abraham Lincoln, like what he looked like before the Civil War and what he looked like 2 years later?
Yeah.
What are we going to look like if there's another 4 years of this?
See, that's pretty funny because it's not the president, it's us. I tweeted out last week, you know, I remember 1980, you know, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? This year, it's going to be, can you take another 4 years of this? I don't know.
I think there are a lot of people who, remember when Jeb Bush said Donald Trump is the chaos candidate?
Yeah.
At the time, I don't think it hurt because people like a little chaos, a little chaos. If you ever date a really crazy girl, it's fun for a while, man. You know, people like drama. People like a little chaos. A little chaos is exciting and it's fun. But like after a few years, it's not so fun anymore. And I actually think that's one of the problems Trump is going to have, is that I do think that there's a point of diminishing returns where people are like, okay, let's settle things down. I feel like we've gotten there.
Yeah, look, let's stick with this image because, you know, in the beginning, he's the chaos candidate. And I do think a lot of voters went, yeah, that sounds cool. We could use a little bit of chaos. Chaos sounds better than the status quo. The status quo sucks. So we're going to go to the chaos party. And it's going to be cool because a lot of people are going to be there and it's going to be wild. And now it's like 4 a.m. and we've spent the whole night at the chaos party. And all the kegs are down, and people are throwing up in the corner. You know, everybody's, you know, you've all been to that party that you were looking forward to and was really going to be fun, and you were going to really let it go. And then, you know, as the dawn comes up, you're going, oh, what the hell was I thinking? This is just terrible.
What happened? And I think this is your next column, Charlie.
Don't you feel that way, though? It's a little bit. I mean, I'm going with the, you know, the. Yeah, hey, we can.
So we had our
she's crazy.
We had our goggles on when we fell in love with Donald Trump, but now,
and now it's the beer guy. You know, we tried the stuff. The guy said, "Hey, come in here, try this stuff in the bathroom. It's cool. All right, you know." And you're thinking that it's going to make you Superman.
Yeah,
and then you realize you're just sitting there, and it's just.
I went to visit Selma Hayek and woke up with Friedrich Hayek.
Oh, but leave Friedrich Hayek out of it. Actually, leave Selma Hayek out of it.
All right, we'll find a better. I'll find a better analogy.
No, you see, that was actually safe because if you would have gone anywhere else, it would have been sexist and offensive or something, right?
But I think
we're knowing where you're going there. There's got to be some perfect analogy.
I don't want a website called Right Wing Watch to follow me with the same interest they follow Pat Robertson.
Yeah, Pat Robertson. I mean, when you have Pat Robertson, when you lose Pat Robertson, you're in a lot of trouble. If you're Donald Trump. So again, we are doing this podcast on Monday, and right now, no one in the world knows what's going to happen in the Middle East. Nobody can predict. I mean, you want to talk about chaos? Is the president going to go through with his announcement? Are the Turks going to invade? Has the president dissuaded the Turks from invading? Is he going to cave in? Is he going to leave the troops there? If so, for how long?
Tune in next week.
What are the Chinese and the Russians and the North Koreans? How are they reading all of this? I mean, this is as much as close to absolute chaos and unpredictable events as you could possibly get. So just mark this as an historical marker. Like, what were people saying on that Monday when nobody knew anything that was going to happen? Right?
Well, just wait till Matt Lewis comes even more unglued. Like, that's going to be lit.
Because... I didn't think you were being unglued. I thought you were becoming more like me.
You thought we were arguing. I thought we were finally talking.
No. I thought you were coming around. You were just going to be the younger, better-looking version. So, hey, Matt Lewis, thank you for joining me again
on
the
Bulwark
Podcast. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode was brought to you by Simply Safe. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.